I'm only here on stage for a brief to introduce the next round of speakers, one of whom will appear on the screen in 1 second because he couldn't come to Berlin but agreed to do his presentation via Skype. Yann Mullier-Bouton. I will introduce both Yann Mullier-Bouton and Liz Fekete, who will do the commentary together, and then we'll join Liz and I will sit here and Yann will keep joining us on the screen. So first of all, Yann Mullier-Bouton, he's a transdisciplinary economist, professor at both the Universities of Technology of Compiègne and Shanghai. His heterodox contributions to economic theory and analysis are informed by his wide-ranging knowledge in the fields of philosophy and social sciences. He's the chief editor of the journal Multitude, which was founded in 2000, to which he also contributes regularly. He's the author of several books, including Cognitive Capitalism, L'Abbé et l'Économiste, and Althusser, a biography. And this is very important to me, he also coined the concept of the autonomy of migration in the late 1990s, an argument which to this day plays a crucial role in the critical migration and border regime studies. The argument of the autonomy of migration, a much discussed concept, was followed by his theorization of the exit or the refusal as political strategy or as political movement. And to quote from an interview, I think from 2001, conducted by Stanley Grillet, and a quote I've used often, when people refuse something, there is a positivity. So after Jan's presentation, there will be a commentary by Liz Fekete. Liz is the director of the Institute of Race Relations in London and head of its European research program. The IRR was established in 1958 as an independent educational charity to carry out research on race relations across the world. In 1972, it underwent a radical transformation into what it is also still today, a kind of an anti-racist think tank. Its focus is on institutionalized racism, which, as you know, plays a very crucial role in the context of the tribunal unraveling the NSU complex. She has worked with the IRR for 29 years, and her area of research and expertise include contemporary racism, refugee rights, far-right extremism, and Islamophobia across Europe. She has also been involved with the NSU complex, or rather the organizing against it, for some time. She's the author of A Suitable Enemy, Racism, Migration, and Islamophobia in Europe, and has served as an expert witness at the Basso Permanent People's Tribunal on Asylum and the World Tribunal on Iraq. She's currently working on a new book, Europe's Fault Lines, Racism and the Cultural Revolution from the Right, which will be published by Verso Books later this year. And I believe Verso is actually doing a International Day of Women's Struggles percentage today. I'm mentioning this just as a segue to remind us that discussion of racism as always have to happen in an intersectional approach. But without further ado, I hand over to Yann Mullier-Bouton. Welcome.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, everyone. Thanks. My deep thanks are going to Cordula and Andreas, who helped me to organize this lecture. Thanks also to Liz Fekete. It's a great honor for me to be commanded by the director of Institute of Race Relation, which was a main reference for us in France, where the culture of race relation is not very extended. I apologize not being among you tonight, but I want to share some of my thoughts about variety, continuity of racism, and also its resilience, which really is a problem for all of us. Racism is much broader than only intolerance toward difference in phenotypes against non-white colored people. It is more than xenophobia or anti-Semitism. It's included also intolerance towards sexual preferences, homophobia, intolerance in religion matters, Christian anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, persecution of many kinds, anti-Christian persecution in Syria, persecution on the very old religion like Yazidi people. But it's also intolerance against beliefs and argument, also again, reason. I mean, communist, liberal, even pro-European during the Brexit campaign are suffering real harsh attacks, and sometimes it go to the murder. I must also include the age problem. I mean, a sort of new form of class age fight. It's a struggle between generation. You can imagine how the youth from the suburbs are treated. Naturally, when something is shown on TV, you always see black French citizen presented as impossible to be integrated and presented as migrant. You have also racism based upon gender issue. We must not neglect a real kind of racism against women from some delirious pretension that the male people are suffering now oppression by females. Anyhow, we can put together of this under the same bundle what leads to discrimination. That is a kind of filter, a way to produce a special effect. That is, what is this effect? This effect is an endogenous stratification among the people that is produced division, hatred, sometimes violence and murder. But this racism, our racism of today, is particularly scandalous because what is really appalling is the resilience of it. That means that reason, enlightening, tradition are of no use to cope with that. On the one hand, economists and liberals were persuaded that market economy associated with a theory, the liberal theory of the individual was supposed to dissipate superstition, obscurantist prejudice, religious intolerance. But it has not been the case, we must recognize. Why is that so? We can explain can we explain such resilience by the bad or sinner nature of human being? My answer is definitely no, until we provide plausible and rational arguments showing that all these kinds of racism are playing a specific role. I would say an economic role, a political role, and something that can be explained very well. And it does. We can provide plausible arguments, and definitely to such extent that after having studied and be quite an activist in migration issue, no man is illegal and so on, in defense of illegal migrants. After having studied this, I not surprised to see the very point where racism is rising and installing in the media, in the vote, and so on. And we are well placed today with National Front. I remember I've tried at the end of my main book, finally, which is From Slavery to a Wage System, that was my PhD. I have dedicated the last chapter to maybe the most typical case of institutionalized racism, which is how the system of South Africa, its apartheid, was progressively established, installed, and how what were the roots of it. One main argument before explaining what is the role of racism is maybe to get rid of one idea, the idea of primitive accumulation. We shall try to show why and how racism became part not only of a primitive accumulation, an original sin, but a continuous accumulation. In the explanation of the birth of states, nation states, and capitalism, it is generally supposed that primitive accumulation is relying upon theft, lies, looting, robbery, murders, war, genocide. But it is also supposed that these events have taken place once for all in a sort of prehistorical period. It is thought that it's only a primitive scene of violence, and only these primitive scenes of violence could produce dispossession, proletarianization. And once the theft has been performed, a new regime can be settled, peaceful, and concealing the past crime and reducing violence to a minimum. And I think we are, most of us, living within this very naive idea that violence had taken place, was a history of the past, but we are so civilized. Economics is doing so smoothly that no doubt that violence is only now operating at the margin of the heart of our developed country. A bit like the overturn of revolution that sets up a new dynasty, and this dynasty spent a lot of time to make this not ineffective, but forgotten. And naturally, it is not so. Like the Cartesian theory of continuous creation, capitalism, to last and abide, must reproduce continuously its power of domination. Racism, in all its meanings, is the ultimate mean to reproduce division. It appears and reappears. Choose one type of its manifestation rather than another one according to the type of problems it is confronted with. It can, for example, provide poor white social consideration destroyed by the market. It can reassure and appease the white colons who were one against 10 black in the former French colony of Saint Domingo, today Haiti. But the use of racism became much more sophisticated, objectified in the functioning of the labor market. And this is quite important because this leads me to my main argument, which is both the argument of autonomy of the movement of the people of migration, inner and international migration, but also the importance of exit versus voice and what was the consequence of this, that is that the main apparatus of power of capitalism aims at controlling this mobility, controlling this continuous flight and exit or exodus, raise continuous problem to the capitalist apparatus of power, repression, police, and so on. In my research about the building up of a wage system and the role of bound labor of inner and international migration, I've tried to show that the main problem of the control of dependent labor has been the enforcement of the contract by employees. At the main response to bounding contract of dependent labor was the flight by the employees, exit versus voice solution. The main problem has been to size the person as a pawn of fulfillment of the contract through various episodes, the first one being serfdom, second one plantation slavery, indentured labor, coolie system, domestic slavery, and finally, free labor controlled by discrimination, enrooted in prejudice or confessed racism, and or by the system of stay and work permit, which plays such a role in the life and in the movement of migrants. This struggle of employees in order to conquer their freedom to move has been the spring of the building up of the wage system and the code of labor, finally forbidding, after a lot of struggle, slavery, and organizing the possibility for the employee to breach the contract, to quit, much more than to be fired by the employers. If you want to understand the strength of the violence of racism, one must understand that shortage of people, control of exodus, fixing labor has been much more important than encouraging mobility and expelling people. One biggest proof of that is the resilience of the topic of the wall. The wall has characterized the history of split Germany after the Second World War, and it ended only in 1989. But the resilience of the wall in Palestine, Israel, or in the Mexican US border, or now at the border of AU, is really shows us that there are big movements that states, capitalism, try to stop in a way or in another. Finally, racism is part of the governance of antagonism. Provide you extend antagonism to something much broader than the pure voice discussion, let's say, people taking, trying to struggle openly. You have much more implicit exodus behavior that plays a big role in our actual world. The use of division between people, workers, according to colors, race, religion, gender, nationality, any kind of division, can be characterized finally as a brittle wage system, because it is not the general feelings, instinct, basic instinct of human in general. It plays a precise role. It resists any unification. It resists a world, a unified world, a unified labor market, a unified circulation of ideas, claims of freedoms, and so on. Today, a new kind of racism is rising between those who masters technology, digital literacy, and the beta minus that are supposed to be excluded from any access to the new ways of power. The psychologist dimension of this antagonism is, for me, but a consequence of a very objectified system within law. It occurs precisely, racism occurs, appears as a major counter-trend to unification of exploited people, of wage earners. A good example, and I will end this little presentation with three examples. A good example can be given with the so-called reserve army effect that plays such a role in the rise today of extreme right-wing political parties, which is a theme of invasion, and how it works among blue-collar workers. The idea that was a classical topics of, let's say, revolutionary and critical wing was the fact that importing labor and migration were something used by employers to break the movement, the workers' movement. And naturally, this was supposed to induce, let's say, decreasing salaries and the division, the new international division of labor according to the place where labor is cheap and condition of works are low. This argument is particularly important when you see that National Front in France and others, right-wing parties in Europe, are really attacking continuously the entrance, even if very moderate, that is, let's say, less than 0.5% per year of the total population, the continuous permanence of migration, international migration, which is presented as responsible for degradation, worsening condition of work, worsening condition of wages, and so on. And the argument is a so-called reserve army effect. But this argument, and I've studied it closely, doesn't work at all for one very simple explanation. If you put, let's say, in a closed box, available manpower and, let's say, a level of wage which has already been fixed according to supply and demand of labor law. Naturally, if you throw in this box or in this bottle, you put some more people asking to work, it will produce, naturally, a sort of, let's say, the level of wage will go, will lower somewhat. But the hypothesis of a closed box is totally false. That is, someone has, for example, spoken of the importance of immigration in UK, but by the same times, UK, and especially England, has been producing continuously emigration, that is, people living. So the box is not closed, or the bottle is not hermetic. So it doesn't produce that. And what you have, the labor market, is a succession of locks and not a sort of river unified. So what you can observe is that migrants, new migrants, incoming migrants, what we call primo migrants, are not free on the labor market. They cannot present everywhere and ask for, let's say, the kind of jobs that autochthonous people are looking for. They cannot, because a system of work permits and of stay permits makes a sort of natural lock and slow down their upper mobility. So you never can observe a reserve army effect. And as soon as these people, this migrant, get citizen right and full access to the labor market, what would you observe? That they immediately adopt the behavior of the national or already regular migrants. That is, they sue the employers, they leave their jobs, they quit in order to find better jobs. So they are not yellow crowd threatening the level of wage and good condition of the national population. Second example, it is very striking that racism always appears to prevent precisely upward mobility of these migrants or their intersectorial movement. For example, when they were introduced and when they are introduced within, first of all, rural jobs, and after to, let's say, socially despised jobs, that is, sewing, food industries, and so on. And naturally, what they are looking for is to penetrate other industrial or service sectors, and sometimes with the numbers they can overthrow the system of control. But when their upward mobility, their self-organization threaten the locks established, preventing them to enjoy the protection of the code of labor, you find immediately a specific racism. For example, against second generation people or third generation, as soon as they have been educated and can penetrate the entry, the labor market of more interesting jobs, you find a sudden, you find really racism installing itself. I have observed this among the educational, the French educational system. So these are examples that racism, we can better understand racism when looking at precisely very, in a very acute way, the functioning of the labor market. And I think this is in that peculiar field that one can all at once preview the rising of racism and struggle against it and try to prevent it. Thank you.
Is that on?
Thank you.
Sorry. Thank you, Yann Moulier-Bouton. And now I have the pleasure to welcome Liz Fekete, who will give a commentary.
Könnt ihr das Mikro auf?
Könnt ihr das auch machen?
Yeah, perfect. I see you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, this isn't fair. I can't see you, and I want to tell you off.
Oh.
You know...
you don't see me? Well.
No, I want to see your face. Oh, here you are. Here's Jan.
Okay, good.
Okay, Jan, I'm going to make a confession to you, and I'm going to make a confession to the audience, who I can no longer see, which is probably a good thing. I'm in a real muddle here. We had a situation where Yang couldn't come through difficult circumstances. Yang, I thought you were my friend. You sent me your notes a couple of hours ago for me to prepare, and you just went all over the world. And I've made a preparation. This is my notes, but I made a preparation about half an hour ago, and I managed to get it under the water in the ladies' loo as well, so it's quite a few water spots. And everything that I put down is now no longer valid. And then something else also happens in the earlier presentation that I thought Bassat was my friend. Where are you, Bassat? Yeah, and she gave this fantastic, polished, wonderful, articulate, beautiful presentation, and I'm reduced to a gibbering wreck. So where are my friends today? So I am going to be very brief, and I'm afraid, Jan, not my friend, this is based on the notes that I made earlier in the ladies' room. So, Jan, I really want to thank you for reminding us of something that we too often forget in our struggles, that racism is intimately interwoven into capitalism, and that racism must be linked to issues of the economy and the socio-economic situation and grounded in that. I felt, Jan, that although you did go all around the world and you did go off the notes that you've given me, I did feel that the main point that you are making is very much that racism is an ideology that is a very useful ideology for the powerful, for the exploiters in society, to divide the working class and to make them do things which are against their interests. So what I want to suggest is that that is a very important thing to be reminded of. But I want to suggest that, and this is very much also from studying the NSU case and being involved in the struggles of people around at the NSU apparatus, that yes, it is ideological racism. It is a way to divide labour, if you like, but it also develops a life of its own when it comes to resides in the structures and the institutions of the state. And that's what we see when we examine the police response to the murders of the NSU victims. And it's also how we learn that racism is what racism does. It may be an ideology, but it is a lived experience. And I think that's very important. I think that, yes, I mean, I work for a journal called Race and Class, so I'm not going to say that class is not important and that exploitation is not important. Otherwise, I'll go back to London and I'll lose my job, which isn't going to be very good in the economic situation there, believe you me. But I think that there is racism today, and I'm sure Jan would agree with me, and I'm sure that was also an emphasis in his contribution, that the anti-Muslim racism that we've seen has not been the classical racism arising out of the exploitation of labour. It is a racism that has emerged out of war, out of, you could say, wars which are about resources, which are about oil, but you could say that is a racism that emerges out of the enemy images that are needed to construct that war. And that how we see in our societies the result of that enemy images for war coming home to the way that our Muslim brothers and sisters in Europe are treated, how any visible sign of Islam is now subject to bans and laws, and how the greater emphasis in our society, our European societies, which are actually becoming increasingly militarized themselves, is about patriotism and creating conformity, and therefore how assimilation in terms of the way that we treat minorities has become the defining way that minority policy is constructed. I think, coming from the UK, where, you know, you might have heard that we had a referendum to leave the EU. Did you hear about that in Germany? I expect you did. I mean, what is so amazing about that referendum? Of course, it became a referendum about immigration. And once it became a referendum against immigration, all those people who tried to say, look, what is going to happen to you, the poorer sections of society, the old industrial working classes, that you are going to suffer. But the whole way that immigration was rammed down people's throat meant that a section of the class, voted against their own interests. And I think in that we see that class is not a homogenous concept. In fact, what I wanted to say, what I was thinking about is, you know, like some of the arguments we've had in the UK over the years as left people, but as anti-racist people, with some of the left groups who take a very, very, let's just say, a position that prioritizes class over race. But you have a situation where people will come and say, black and white, unite and fight, because this is about capitalism and about class. But for many of our black brothers and sisters, they will say they don't feel comfortable with that, because who is the leader when we unite? I also remember a story from the civil rights period in the United States, when the more liberal elements of the civil rights movements were saying, we shall overcome, and that was becoming the anthem of the movement. And then Stokely Carmichael came along and said, well, black power, now do you feel comfortable saying that? So I'm saying, within the issues of marginalised and vulnerable people, there are also contradictions. And if racism is what racism does, then the people who experience racism, we have to listen to them, and we have to tackle racism from their own their vantage point. You know, I'm doing a lot of work at the moment around the deaths of migrants and refugees at European borders, which was why I was delighted that Jan really, really prioritised issues of migration and immigration. And, you know, one thing that struck me when Aisha introduced the session this evening is how important it was for Aisha to actually read the names of those who were killed by the NSU. And I think that's so important, because for those of us who've worked around the NSU, you know, it can become, after years, and we're sort of become sort of obsessed with what the state did and what the police did, and we can start to talk about it as a case rather than a lived experience where people were killed and families were ripped apart. And one thing that I find in the work that I'm doing about the deaths of migrants and refugees at the border, I keep an archive as much as I can on everybody who's dying at the borders, whether it's through the fact in Greece over the winter there was not adequate, in the so-called hotspots, there was not adequate conditions for the refugees, so they were living in tents in Arctic conditions and have died of hypothermia, or through trying to keep warm through gas canisters that have exploded. There was 13 refugee and migrant deaths in Greece over the last months. And I'm just writing about what's going on at an Hungarian, Bulgarian, Serbian border, where there have been 6 deaths. I can tell you, in most of those deaths, we do not have a name. We don't even have the name of the dead. So I think our struggles against racism is a racism linked to capitalism and exploitation, but it is also always at the bottom line a struggle for human dignity and for memorialising and keeping alive the memory of those who've lost their lives because of racism. Thank you. And I forgive you, Jan. I do, yes. Could we turn that into wine?
Does anyone have those qualifications to turn water into wine?
Gin and tonic.
So this is going to be an interesting discussion with Jan hearing us through the microphone? You hear us, right?
Yeah. I'm hearing you perfectly.
But you can't see the audience, I believe. I think because of the progress time, we'll just sort of start opening it up immediately to questions. Although I would like to sort of say thank you, Liz, also for bringing it back to the opening.
May I introduce Cordula? May I reply shortly? Cordula?
Yeah.
No, she had.
Yeah, you mean me?
Cordula.
I'm Nana. You want to talk to Cordula Hammschmidt from the house? Who's in the room with us?
No. It doesn't matter. I wanted to introduce a short comment on Lee's very moving speak.
Yeah.
I'm not. I understand perfectly what she said, and I agree totally with her. Do you hear us?
Yeah, we heard you perfectly.
Okay. But I don't think... I'm not speaking of racism only as an ideology or a sort of proposition of prejudice. I'm speaking of... racism produced precisely by something which is the working and stay permit. I remember that destruction of the apartheid in South Africa began with a big demonstration in 1960 of the women who burn their pass, that this without this pass they could not circulate it in the territory. And I think that these are traces, material traces of the apparatus producing after hatred, racist thoughts, and so on. So I don't think that racism is only an ideology. I think it's some very precise machine, and I did appreciate the first lecture that was able to really explain point by point, staple by staple, how some mechanism is created and after, as you said, Lise, is working by itself and became a sort of automat that produced its own effects. So I have no... I don't think... I do appreciate your suggestion, and I agree fully. But really, I'm not speaking of racism as an ideology. I'm interested by racism as produced by law. By law, by government action, by behavior of the police, and by all these things that have been described very clearly in the first time of this evening. The first lecture.
Thank you, Jan. Liz, did you want to respond, or shall we? Yeah, I just want to say thank you for doing these important connections first in terms of the role of racism in relation to capitalism, the question of the control of mobility, which is twofold, I would say, and also the connections between migration and racism. Yeah, without further ado, I would like to take a first round of questions. You have to make yourself visible and speak into the microphone as in the first. There's a question here in the very front. We take maybe a few questions.
Hello, thank you very much. I don't really have a question. I have more something that I really want to share, which is I kind of feel very uncomfortable as a person of color to listen about racism from two white people, what it means and what the struggle is with racism. And I'm not so, I thought maybe there are other people who could really talk about this issue in another way. And this is also a problem that we have in institution, that people of color or people do have this kind of perspective, perspectives are not being heard. So this is just what I want to say.
Thank you. Are there more comments or questions? None. I would, I don't know, would you like to hear a response, or you just voice that as a commentary? I think it's a very important point. I would say, though, that the struggle against racism needs, is sort of a, is a shared struggle, but that wasn't what you were saying. You were saying that in terms of the who's speaking, and maybe I should add that aside from sort of what we do today and tomorrow this continues. This is kind of announcing it ahead of time. Tomorrow we have two contributions, a presentation by Manuela Boyajiev and a commentary by Bülent Kucuk, and followed by a panel discussion on racism, the state we're in, with Amira Haas, Hamid Khan, Alana Lentin, and Chaura Makarimi. And I think maybe that'll provide some of the speaking positions that you were missing in this very moment, in this contribution. But, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah? I see signs in the back. Oh, all the way in the back here.
Yeah, hi.
Thank you.
Okay, sorry, I'm not really responding to the issue that was just addressed, because I'm also another white person, so I would kind of, I'm totally open to give the microphone to other people who wish to raise their hands. But the question I would like to pose to Jan is, you were talking about various kinds of racism, including based on sexual orientation, gender, and so on in the beginning. I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on that, because I understood you saying not that like it's racism intersecting with gender and other issues, but you were kind of framing divisions based on gender, on sexual orientation, etc., as racism, right? So I was thinking, for instance, about the comments that Foucault made on the issue of, in German, it's Entartung. I'm not quite sure what the French or English terms would be, but kind of literally deviating from race, that were applied both to people of color and to homosexuals. So I would see that as a kind of discourse that is kind of operating homosexuality through race, and vice versa. But I'm not quite sure if that is the kind of thing you were addressing when you were talking about all these different divisions in terms of racism, or what would be the value of calling them racism rather than specifying sexism and other kinds of power.
Well, this is, I think that this is a kind of splitting of society, which is very important. And if you look in some societies in Africa or even elsewhere, it becomes a new line of division, which is also linked to the visibility in society of people that are not, in matters of sexual preference, like the majority. And this racism is intolerance against anything which is thought to be not only different, but deviating. And I think if you look at what is going on in certain states of Africa where and modernizing states, you can be very surprised why such prejudice have become part of exclusion where society has cannot split around color issues or around only gender issues or around minority, ethnical minority issues. And the question we must ask is why this appears, in which moment, how it works, and to which this crime benefits. And this is why I put it together with others' lines of division. And naturally, they could also be shared and overlapping. That is, some guy discriminated as, or some girl discriminated as black or colored, maybe also discriminate as homosexual. And some Jews can be discriminated as homosexual too, and so on. So racism is a mint, is a sort of matrix that produce various effects, but the mechanism is still the same, provide you had the very important qualification Lees has introduced, that at some point, when deeply enrooted in tradition, in sort of the custom of society, it grows by itself. And sometimes it contradicts the interest, the capitalist interest that have settled it. In South Africa, whereas the employers were very much for division by races of the population or people within reserve and people in the town, they deeply opposed the apartheid institutionalization because it cost a lot to main industries, and finally they tried to get rid of, but it was too late. That is, it was a sort of automatus, a sort of Frankenstein that was writing for its own sake. And I think that in England, the kind of opposition to Europe involving it has gone to the up to the point of murdering a woman member of parliament that was for the Remain. I think indubitably employers were not in favor of the Brexit, and that was some motivation for Brexiters, for working class sectors, to vote the Brexit. And I think that we encounter continuously today in France the same problem. That is, once it is installed and really becomes part of the habits, of political habits, it has its own autonomy, and it's very difficult to manipulate it, because one error is only to reduce racism as a mere manipulation, a plot by some elites or counter-elites. So is that, does this answer your question or not?
He doesn't have the microphone anymore. But I would like to jump in and add something of, since we spent, which you don't know, but many of us spent the whole day discussing already, that I think, Aisha, it was also you who pointed out, or maybe it was Heike Kleffner, the researcher for the Parliamentary Inquiry Committee on the NSU, who pointed out that the NSU, the National Socialist Underground Network, targeted specifically small entrepreneurs. So not only those who are no longer within the factories, so the ones who sort of assume a kind of independence from that kind of market, but also young men, or in particular men, who, where it was clear it was meant to be sort of interrupting a possible line of genealogy, which I think is maybe a different way of addressing not the whole sort of complex relations between racism and sexism that we'll leave for a discussion. And that's going to be sort of, I mean, if you take into account things like the rape lynching complex, et cetera, or the construction of the supposedly dangerous young black men, the sort of sexualization of that, but to look at this, the way it addresses sort of the interruption, the idea of genealogy. And that is, of course, particularly crucial within Germany, where the idea of citizenship is based on sort of national belonging, where German citizenship is still based on the idea of the law of the blood, the jus sanguinis. And I think that was actually one of the things that was quite new to me in pointing out that the direction of those murders, those racist murders in the series of killings by the NSU trio, included that aspect as well.
Thank you so much.
Are there more questions or comments? Please, wants a drink. I know it's very late, and
I can see if
there's more. So I would like to thank all of you for being here. And as I already said, we continue tomorrow with two rounds of presentations and discussions. And we end actually the 2 days of the apparatus of racism with a panel discussion, which will have very divergent analysis and speculations on the contemporary state of racism in various locations. So I hope to see you all back tomorrow. And thank you. Jan.